Welcome to another episode of the On Wonder podcast. I'm Sarah Kinsella.
And I'm Brenda Del Monte.
And today we're joined by Amanda Soper, who is a speech and language pathologist and a teacher of the visually impaired based in Washington, D.C. And Amanda owns a private practice called AAC Creatively Communicating and recently co-founded a nonprofit organization, the Infinite Learning Foundation. So we hope you'll share a little bit about that, Amanda. It's nice to meet you. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about your nonprofit?
So I just started the nonprofit this past year with two occupational therapists that I've been working with for a while now. We're looking for some grant funding right now for some projects, but we're hoping to be able to share more practical and also theory information about literacy in AAC, and really try to make literacy more accessible to individuals who use AAC. Good instruction is good instruction. And we have over the years been frustrated and mused on, like, how come, you know, and I know you guys did an entire season talking about literacy and AAC. Why is in special education are we not always doing what we know we should be doing? And so we're hoping to provide resources and materials and more training so that everyone feels comfortable and not only believes that their students can learn how to read, but has the tools to make that happen in schools or homeschooling, however kids are learning. So
that's awesome. I have a nonprofit too. And I feel like sometimes that's the only way to get the information out that you really need to do. I met you at ATIA in January and you were doing a class, and I loved your introduction because you talked about how you were a speech pathologist, and then tell us your little journey about how you became also a TBI.
Yeah. So I have been a speech pathologist for about 13 years and a TBI. I just finished grad school a couple years ago, so relatively recent. But I primarily work with kids who have pretty complex needs. And when I first started about 10 years ago working with kids who had more complex needs and needed AAC, I kept hearing the term CBI, but I didn't really understand what it meant. I Googled it. Like, people gave me like the CBI range and they were like, here, like, this is, you know, the tool, but like, I have no idea what to do with it. And I was like, oh, sure. Okay, yeah, cool. And so I would like read PowerPoint handouts or like stuff online, but I didn't really understand it. And I had a lot of kids who had been sort of written off, like that they were not going to be able to use AAC because they had pretty significant physical challenges and vision challenges, including CBI. Mm-hmm. And I just like, I don't buy that. And I just didn't buy that they couldn't use something. So I got started with high-tech AAC with all of the kids I was working with. And then I had a handful of kids that I just felt like should be making more progress or could be making more progress if I knew more. But basically, there's a huge shortage of teachers of the visually impaired across the U.S. So
right. It's
really hard to find someone to consult with.
Mm-hmm.
But then even when I was finding people to consult with, there's a lot of differences in how speech therapists look at AAC and symbols versus how teachers of the visually impaired look at symbols and AAC. And so then I was not agreeing with anybody about where they wanted to start versus where I wanted to start. So I just decided I'll just go back to school and I'll get another degree and I'll learn more. And I'm really glad and grateful that I did. I had the teacher I went to Salus University, and Dr. Kathy Alstrin was my neurovision professor, and it was just an incredible class. And I feel like I walked away with so many more tools and things I wanted to try, and also just such a better understanding of CBI.
That is something that has come up this whole series is that we do need to do better at collaborating with each other and hearing each other out and moving language forward despite the vision. And so it's like we have to hold true to what we know to what we know about that. But you started off the class that I was at talking about the difference, the even the terminology that Cortical visual impairment versus cerebral. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when I first went back to school, I was using the word cortical to denote CVI as cortical vision impairment. And then when I was in this neurovision class, that was quickly like a no, we're not calling it that. And this is why. And so Dr. Ahlstrand had brought in lots of other resources. I feel like the go-to when you hear CVI, at least me as an SLP, and I think a lot of people in special education who are non-SLPs, we know Dr. Roman Lancey and the cortical vision impairment term and the cortical vision impairment range. But there's actually more than just the visual cortex, which is so the CVI range, cortical vision impairment, refers to the little visual cortex in the occipital lobe at the back of the brain, right? But what we know is that vision is actually happening in multiple parts of the brain. It's not just the visual cortex. And so, particularly Dr. Amanda Lewick, but there's a book also called Vision and the Brain by Dr. Lewick and Dr. Dutton. And they instead are using the term cerebral. And I think a lot of people in the field are moving towards cerebral rather than cortical because you might not have damage in the visual cortex. It might be somewhere else in the brain, right? It might be the parietal lobe, might be the temporal lobe, but it still is going to impact your visual processing. And so if we're limiting it to cortical, we're maybe only thinking of those 10 characteristics that are on the CVI range. But if we're thinking cerebral, there's actually over like 50 characteristics that we can look at and think about. And maybe be more specific too, right? If we know where in the brain there it was impacted or there was damage, then we know what might have been impacted in visual processing, and we can better plan. Or maybe we recognize some characteristics, and that might lead us to think, hey, maybe it was this part of the brain. Hey, are these other things associated with it, right? So just sort of making that switch from cortical to cerebral and thinking about it's more than the visual cortex. There's vision everywhere in the brain, so.
Well,
And
okay, so that's new for me. That's new learning. Thank you. So essentially, you're making it a little bit more broad because by using the term cerebral, because there may be more characteristics. Can you explain for those who aren't familiar with some of the characteristics that you're talking about? Can you explain a few of those, what does it means, and why that's important for us to know about?
Yeah, so I think one of the most common ones that people think about is like visual complexity, right? So, how complex is the object? How complex is the background? So, complexity of an object might be that it's a little bit easier to visually attend to and recognize something that's maybe only one color or two colors, but the more colors that are involved, the more complex it is. Or complexity of the background or environment would be like when you're reading a book like Brown Bear, right? It's just that one colored animal on a page, not very complex. But if you had going on a bear hunt and it's a brown bear against the brown background of the cave, it might be significantly more complex and difficult for the child to see the outline of the bear and know this is the bear on the cave background. And then environment, thinking about our classrooms, God, all the noise, everyone walking around, who's playing YouTube in the corner, who's yelling in the corner, who's laughing next to me, and then just dropped all my books off the table. And so all of the extra noise, all the extra visual things happening around, that would, increase the complexity of the environment. So all of those things could impact your ability to visually process what's going on. Another one that is like pretty common, and that is usually one of the things that parents will bring up to me that maybe start making me think, hey, have you guys looked at CVI, our visual field deficits? So for a lot of individuals with CVI, in particular, having like a lower visual field deficit. So the way I explain it to help people understand is usually I say like, hey, like put your hand at your nose flat, and then try to look down. And what can you see? You can't really see your feet. And so a lot of the kids I work with, maybe on the stairs they're super hesitant and they're using their foot to feel for the edge of the step, or they're afraid to climb out of bed in the morning because they have a difficult time seeing and recognizing where the floor is. Maybe they turn on their stomach and then they're tapping their foot on the floor. So those are just two of the characteristics, but basically they're like these visual behaviors that you might notice, that would give you an idea that there might be some difficulties with visual processing.
So, what are some of the characteristics that you might think about that make you think it's more of a cerebral vision impairment?
So to be honest, I rarely, if ever, use the term cortical.
Okay.
And I think for those who are looking at Dr. Lewick's work and Dr. Dutton's work, in the TBI field, more people are just making the shift to cerebral versus cortical.
Okay.
You can have cortical visual impairment with no, you're not nearsighted, you're not farsighted, there's no acuity problem, it's processing. So it makes sense, it made sense to me when you were talking about it. And that at that time, Sarah, that was a new idea to me too. And then since then, if you look it up, cerebral visual impairment, there's tons of stuff about it. So it's like, okay, now we're talking about, but unfortunately, maybe that the acronyms the stays the same. So there's not a
Okay.
lot of distinction there. Yeah.
So yeah, unfortunate because the acronym's the same. And I think a lot of people in general just know Dr. Roman's
Yeah.
name and don't know Dr. Lewick necessarily, right? And don't know that there is this whole other body of research and talk. But I think so when I've been doing assessments recently, like functional vision assessments, or when I'm talking with other SLPs and we're sort of teasing out thinking through the language, cerebral versus cortical, one of the big things that I like to point out is that on the CVI range, there's these 10 characteristics, and you're scoring each characteristic individually, how it impacts the individual, but also how all of them collectively impact the individual. And essentially, you're saying that every individual has all 10 of these characteristics, and they manifest to similar degrees. Like as you're progressing on the CVI range, your scores are sort of progressing similarly in each area, right? But in cerebral, when you're looking at Dr. Lewick's CVI profile, there's these 50 characteristics across, I forget to be honest, like 13 or 15 categories.
Yeah.
And what she's saying is you actually might have one characteristic, you might have all 50. Like it is super and totally unique to the individual. And part of going back to school was because I was really frustrated when we were doing some functional vision assessments for kids who did not fit the CVI range. And I was getting really frustrated at underscoring or overscoring parts just to sort of seemingly make it fit that they had all these characteristics. And I didn't feel that way about them. Like for instance, some of my students who really struggle with like a visually guided reach, so looking and reaching at the same time, who have visual field deficits, who have difficulty in really complex environments when there's a lot of noise and vision, are using an Accent 1000 with Unity 84 sequenced, so a grid size of 84 with Pixon symbols, which are pretty abstract symbols. And so while they might be on the CVI range for most characteristics, looking like they're in phase two, you would not be able to visually interpret and use symbols or icons, right? And so the TBI would be like, well, it's like an anomaly that they're using this AAC device, or like, I don't think they really understand it. I'm like, she just put together a three-word phrase. What do you mean she doesn't understand what she's doing? So I think that's sort of why I think it's important that we make the distinction and why we really think about cerebral versus cortical is that it doesn't have to be all 10 of those characteristics. And if we actually are looking at the bigger group, we can be more specific about each individual student and like what their specific needs are. And then I can plan better intervention. I could help them more.
Right.
Let's talk about the LAMP or the Unity 84. Or so For those of you listening, it means there's 84 buttons, and that's a lot on a screen for somebody who has any kind of visual impairment. So for those that don't understand the idea behind motor planning, just talk to us about how, because in my mind, that's how you're helping these kids get pretty successful. They're using vision, but they're also not having to tax their visual system by having that visual field. That visual system, the system doesn't change that much. So talk a little bit about that system.
So yeah, it's a little complex and it's hard. Sorry for those of you who are listening without a visual. But essentially, it's a little bit more than motor planning with Unity. If you are using especially Unity on an accent device, so it's a little different than Lamp Words for Life, which is similar but not the same.
Right.
If you're using Unity on an accent device, you can use how the system was originally designed, which means that you turn off the embellished or alternative icons. And so what does that mean? That means on your home screen, we're going to use the 84 like grid. So on your home screen, you have 84 icons. 71 of those icons are unique icons that represent like some sort of category, whether it's a grammar category or a semantically related category. On every secondary and third tertiary like page, all of the home screen, so not the noun categories, not our noun fringe words, but all of the more core words, that second and that third page look exactly the same as the first page. They're identical. You don't change the home screen, essentially. So for example, if I wanted to say jump versus run versus walk on Unity 84, on my home screen, I select the shoe button on the top right side or middle right side. It opens up to a second page. And on this second page, I can either select my green action man, which will say walk, or I could select the shoe again, which leads to a third page. And then I can select the action man to say run. Or I could select my shoe on the home page, the bed on the second page, which is where sleep would be on the home page, and then the green action man, and now it says jump. Essentially, what I'm doing is reducing this visual load for kids. So on most systems, every page has single meaning icons, which means every word is represented by a different icon. In Unity, they're using a different type of language representation method, which is called semantic compaction or MinSpeak. And so essentially, we're learning a very small set of icons. So similar to the alphabet has 26 letters, Unity 84 has 71 icons or symbols, and we're going to combine those icons or symbols in unique ways to make thousands of words. So most of my kids don't need to visually scan every page every time they're right. trying to say a new word, because they know where the bed is, they know where the shoe is, they know where the stop sign is, they know where the apple is. And so if I'm teaching them a new word and I say, oh, that's bed, stop sign, action man, they're fluently going to bed, stop sign, action man. They don't have to visually scan on those second and third pages to find those symbols. So
right. And I love your explanation, and it's hard. It's super hard if you're not looking at it, but
yeah.
I kind of talk to people about it. Like it's like coming to your home screen at ASDF, right? And it's pretty arbitrary, honestly, where those locations of those letters are. And it's not even really by frequency anymore. And it's not really, you know, there's, it, but once you know the motor plan, you've got it down. It doesn't make sense that Q is above the A. If you're trying to cognitively make sense about our keyboard, but once you know how to do it all. So if you're thinking, okay, foot and bed equals jump, why is bed there or whatever? It's like, don't overcomplicate it. It's the bottom left and the bottom right, actually. And the bottom right is always going to get you to that. It's like you, if you're not trying to visually, make sense of the motor sequence necessarily. Although we could talk about, well, monkeys jump on the bed or whatever, but you know what I mean? Like you could probably go that route with a lot of them, but some of them I'm like, I don't know how they got there. I'm not sure.
So they used to put out, or there is, if you, it is online. I have it downloaded
Yeah,
somewhere
I've
on
seen
my
that too.
computer, but there is an original manual. And so they actually, you
There
can
was some thought.
reason through every icon sequence. And so when
Sure.
you're adding more words to the device too, like you want to be thoughtful about where you're adding that second and third icon. I'm actually working right now with Gail Van Tainhoven, Brandy Wendland on creating resources, because Gail uses what she calls the symbol family intervention like
Yeah.
approach. And it's actually like, it's so helpful because you're practicing each symbol family. So I'm practicing the shoe and I'm talking about how I'm making up a story that goes along with it. And so I might talk about how I'm jumping on the bed. I put on my shoes before I go for a walk.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
I like get down on the floor to crawl. Like you kind of can think through each icon. So you can make a story for kids who do need some help,
Some
like
cognitive things
linguistically and
to that.
semantically, sort of mapping them. But also, I don't necessarily go through that explanation for every symbol. You're right. Like what I am going through though is the icon name. It's the shoe, the bed, the action man. And so my kids are sort of mapping the icon names. And they, once they have the motor plan down, they have the motor plan down, but they can use their vision successfully to learn new words because they only have to know 71 icons for most words.
I
Which
remember being blown away though, because Jeremy Legaspi's the rep for us for PRC here in Arizona, and he has a video of a girl who was born without eyeballs, and she is using 84 Unity successfully, writing sentences, conjugating verbs, all of it. And when I saw that, I was like, all right, there are still viable options for people that don't have any vision at all, including auditory preview or listening to something before you make a selection. So what I think is interesting is we go down this road a little bit where we think language requires vision, but actually it doesn't. There are perfectly functional blind adults in our community all the time that are college degrees and are doing amazing, and they're blind and their language has developed just fine. So inherently, low vision doesn't mean low inability to learn language.
so I think it has to do with like the visual hierarchy or like a visual representation hierarchy.
Okay.
Because I think in the speech field, right, we threw that out years ago and we said there is no hierarchy. You don't have to master objects before we give you photographs, before I give
Right.
you abstract symbols.
Right.
For vision, I think there's a difference between receptive language and expressive language,
Yes.
but because AAC uses icons for expressive language, here's where everything falls apart. So receptively, I understand how looking, holding my cup and seeing my physical cup might help me get a better visual representation of what a cup is. So the object might help me understand it better than the picture.
Right.
So for receptive language, yes, I can understand, and I don't disagree with TBIs that having objects, looking at photographs, will help me better understand what these things are. For expressive language with AAC, though, I do not care if my clients know that the little juice can on the symbol for drink is a juice can. And I'm not going to give them an object of a juice can to represent juice. I don't care. What I need them to know is that that icon is called juice or called drink. And that when you combine it in different ways, it makes different words.
You get all
I
your birds.
don't need them to visually interpret the symbol and understand and know exactly what it is in real life. I need them to know the name of the symbol and how, in context, when I use this symbol with this symbol, it means this word. And I think that's where we have sort of gone awry with AAC and vision. And I think, unfortunately, because most AAC systems use single meaning icons, right? Unity is the only one that uses semantic compaction. So most systems are going to use single meaning icons. And so there is a level of you having to look at the picture and visually interpret what is this symbol saying. I'm still not saying that you can't use that. You can. But I think we need to let go of this. They need to understand every element of it. No, they need to be able to recognize the symbol and understand what the word is in context. And I think that's the difference. And so coming from a vision perspective, they're really like, no, they need to know what it is and what it means and what it represents. It's not necessarily what I care about for AAC. I care about them being able to use that in context, expressing
Yeah,
it.
I think that's a really, really important distinction. And like you said before, when you're saying the name of the symbol and you're also teaching it to them, right? So that is how they're learning it. They're learning that you're teaching them the, specifically where to find things and making it connect with them. And then when this happens, something happens. There's a communication interaction when you touch that button.
One hierarchy system that I'm struggling with is this hierarchy of cause and effect. So I'll hear a lot like, well, you can't do AAC yet. They don't have all the levels of cause and effect. And then I go back to like, I don't know, Karen Kangas or something. It's like, you're a human being. You were born with cause and effect. You cry, you get your mom. Like, why are we hammering that you have to hit the switch to make the jog jump 9 times out of 10 before we do AAC? So talk to me about this cause and effect hierarchy that seems to be running the vision dialogue and also conflicting with ever getting to the AAC system.
So I'm not gonna lie, you could really put me on a tangent right now because I still have SLPs that I butt heads with who also are stuck on cause and effect.
Okay, well, you know what? Fair. No, that's fair.
Like I have
This is not a vision teacher TBI problem. This is just a problem.
it's just a
Okay.
problem. Like I
Okay,
have a
let's
kid
talk about it.
using a high-tech AAC device with me and using mostly single words, but sometimes combining. And I showed up at his house 2 weeks ago. There was a Big Mac, and I was like, where did this come from? And his
Right.
parents were like, oh, the other SLP suggested we buy it because he does a
They
code
don't
change
have
with
cause and effect or
speech and
something. And I'm like,
OT. I was like, what do you mean he doesn't have cause and effect? Like, did you hear him ask you to put on that TV show? And the parents were like, yeah, but. And I was like, no, put me in touch with this SLP right
All
now.
right, so
But I think, I hear what you're saying though, and this is part of what I was running up against when I was not also a TVI, right? So I think again, it sort of comes back to this like needing to visually demonstrate that you processed and you understood it. But cause and effect, there's not levels of cause and effect. You understand that your actions have an effect on others. So honestly, like things I'll bring up, like, oh, can your kid turn on the TV or change the channel? That's cause and effect. Can they cry because their food is finished and they want more and they know you'll get that's cause and effect. Like, we don't need to prove all these levels of cause and effect with different things. I don't need them to go to the kitchen and get their plate to show me that they want to eat. Again, now you're making it about how they can use an object to represent something. Already told you, I don't care about your vision hierarchy for expressive language. And yeah, I'm just testing them. Like, have I in EI suggested to families while we're also working out AAC, like, hey, why don't you put the cup in an accessible place so they can just bring you the cup instead of trying to climb up the refrigerator, right? Like, of course, like, I think all of us use those things as strategies, but it doesn't negate that we still need to be looking at robust AAC and how quickly can we get kids to robust AAC. And I think part of besides the cause and effect, like what I've seen is that then it seems to like lend itself to these really limited AAC systems where you have like a field of five icons and then another field of five. And like one, you either need a partner who's really like a smart, savvy partner and can navigate the crap out of that device to get you to the page that you might want to communicate on. Or kids are having to navigate like 25 buttons in this field of five to say a single word, which like Of course, they're barely progressing beyond single words and context-dependent communicators. Who the heck has the time and has a partner willing to wait for you to navigate 25 buttons?
Right.
And so I think, yeah, like part of the leveling of cause and effect that I see is also this like leveling of understanding categories. So like, can I navigate here and then navigate here and then navigate here and then navigate here? Who cares? Like, why do I need to make them do all this navigation? Yeah, obviously I could talk about this forever on a soapbox. It makes me so
No, but
frustrated.
it's validating because when people say, well, you can't do AAC yet, that we're still working on cause and effect. And I mean, this is the kid who's doing like what you're saying, like, you know, they can do a lot of things. And I'm like, what? I feel like we're trying to test cognition before we teach language and give them the opportunity to use language. And we only learn language by using it, right? We say buh, we get bubbles, we learn that buh gets bubbles. I mean, this even if we're talking about verbal children. So it's like, why we've not made them hit a button to make the dog flip 10 times before they can say the word bubble. I mean, you know, so it's like the other thing I feel like is that we've changed the requirements, the precursors of language for those that are not functionally verbal yet that we would never demand of a verbal child. And it's based on their vision.
So I've been really frustrated because lately there was recently an article that came out in an ASHA publication about AAC for CVI, and obviously the names are way bigger than my name, right? But they are really talking about, they're calling this robust AAC because it's on a tablet, but it is by no means robust when
Right.
you have a field of five and are doing this wild navigation to get to things.
Right.
That's not robust.
Yeah.
Robust, you can change morphology. You have the ability to make syntactically correct utterances. You have 300 plus words at a minimum. You have access to the keyboard. Like, these systems that are being customized for kids with CVI that are a mixture of photographs, some symbols, some Roman bubble words, like they're just a hodgepodge. And I think it speaks to not understanding AAC. I think it speaks to not understanding language development. It speaks to not understanding that we don't need kids to jump through all these hoops because we wouldn't make any other kid jump through all these hoops if they didn't have CVI. I kind of, in that vein, I want to hop back to like something you said right at the beginning of the podcast. So I actually work a lot with clients who have pretty significant physical impairments, and so vision is also their only access method, or
Exactly.
it's their best access method, their
Yeah.
relative strength. And so like I have right now, she just turned two, but I started working with her at like 16 months, I think. And we went high tech eye gaze immediately. We're waiting for her device to get funded. And I will say, like, did the first time I put it in front of her, was she able to access it? Not really. Like, she looked at it and something happened on the screen, right? But we have seen crazy improvements in her functional vision because she's using high-tech eye gaze and we're doing
Right.
games, we're doing some communication. But without access to that, without asking her and giving her a purpose to use her vision, like, of course, she's not
Right.
using her vision. But when
Right.
there's a purpose to using your vision, you use your vision.
Right.
CVI is not a static diagnosis. It's
Right.
visual processing. And with good intervention, you can make gains in your ability to visually process and to understand what you're seeing and make sense of the world around you. And so
Right.
I think like that's the other thing. Like when we're thinking that kids need to prove that they can use XYZ before we'll give it to them. Why? Kids don't
Yeah.
have to prove they can talk before we talk to them. Like,
Right.
no, we should be giving them access to robust AAC with an access method that we know is their relative best access method.
Exactly.
And then let's teach it. Like, that's our job as interventionists, right? Is to know how to use tools to be doing like ongoing assessment and thinking through what do I need to change up? What do I need to do differently? But we shouldn't. I think in CVI and AAC, unfortunately, we've thrown up all these barriers again to AAC. And while We've made strides in the AAC community about getting kids access to AAC. We know there's still huge pockets where there's a clear candidacy model, but we have imposed a candidacy model for kids with CDI separate from all other kids. And I think that that's really unfortunate and not fair or necessary.
And it's nice that, you know, people like you who have the experience with TBI and being an SLP to be able to talk about these things. We can't all do that, but we can certainly learn from each other and kind of challenge our own assumptions of what we're doing, you know, both SLPs and TBIs. Going back to the example of having five like symbols or icons on a screen, as a TBI, what would you say? Because I'm imagining that someone would say, but that's what they can see, and that is what we know they can see. What would you say to that?
I mean, again, I think that you are testing kids with that field of five over and over. You're not actually inviting them to authentically communicate. If you were, you wouldn't have the same idea about what they can see and what they could do. With that field of five, what I'm generally seeing is, like I said, a mixture of photographs, symbols, and words. Number one, AAC is not a testing or teaching tool for literacy. Is oral language the foundation of literacy? Yes. But does that mean kids need to prove that they can read words on an AAC device and it's helping them become literate? No, like they are different things. Like you should be teaching literacy separate from the AAC device, like learning to read. And a big thing I'm seeing with kids with CBI is they're putting bubble words as the icon. And so, yeah, maybe you're right. Now it's difficult for them to visually scan and distinguish these small differences in bubble words. So maybe they can only have five words there to look through and figure out, but that's your fault because you made the decision to use bubble words instead of symbols. And you made the decision to use single meaning symbols instead of using symbol chaining or semantic compaction. Like, no, you're testing their visual scanning and their visual discrimination with this field of five. And that's like PECs all over again. I don't care about your visual scanning and your visual discrimination long-term. Do you need to use that as you're learning the AAC system? Yes, as you're learning where the icons are. Yes, but we're not moving them. And if we're giving you something that's more robust, like you're learning where the location of those are, you're learning how to use them in context. And I don't need to be testing you over and over and figuring out how is this symbol different from this symbol and how it will take you to this other page. So,
no, I can't, and I wish I could find this research. I got to ask Lauren Enders, and I talked about it, so maybe she knows, but she was like, the number, like the reason why there's device abandonment is because either the people aren't either the people around them aren't trained in it enough to even have it out, right? Or it's not robust enough. So what kills me is I might set someone up with a limited field because they are 1 year old and still learning eye gaze, and we don't have the visual overload is real. And then I'll come back 5 years later for a reeval and they've never progressed. They're still at whatever the 15 button start was or whatever. So I think the other thing that happens is it's like, this is what they can see. We don't want to challenge it. So we don't ever grow the language either. So I think there's a couple reasons why that we see abandonment. It'll be like, well, because they're actually tired of saying those same things. Like they're not able to increase their language skills without a lot of navigation if you stick with the five buttons, right? You have to be moving forward. Sometimes what I do with that is I have big buttons and then I have a link to like a 60 grid or something, and they can visually link over to the 60 grid and they show you that they can go to the 60 grid and pick things out of that. And they're the ones that prove my point that when they're ready, they want to access more language. They can converge on smaller icons and they remember where those locations are. And so the other thing is, it's just like making sure they have, even if you are at odds, I'm always like, okay, but I'm going to put more on this side. And well, you know, they can play around with it because I can't leave it at four buttons or two or whatever it is.
I, I think another like piece of that though too is, and I don't know how what everybody's model is, but I think when the model is that you have people doing AAC evals, but they're not following the kid, right? There is a lack of training for SLPs
For
like
sure.
to be able to follow through. So like the 2-year-old that I'm seeing, did I start with a giant button on the screen? But in 2 days later, I had her
Right.
on grid of 4, and a week later, we were on 8.
Yeah.
And my short-term, long-term goal by the time she's 3 is to get her to 28 grid, right?
Right.
But I'm seeing her frequently, and I'm constantly making adjustments. And in that first month that she had
Challenging
this
it.
device, I saw her almost daily, to be honest. And I was constantly adjusting. Okay, here's where she's at. Here's where she's at. And the parents were adjusting. And I think a big part of our problem is we have people doing evals at like eval centers. And so you're right, they're afraid to challenge the vision piece because they're also not going to see them. And who knows who's going to be following this kid and supporting this kid. And so I think it's easier to bow down to what we hear visually they can access, but I don't think that TV, having been through school, I don't think that TBIs have a strong understanding of language development. And I think as SLPs, we need to start advocating more and being more clear about what language development looks like, how we develop language, how we support language development with AAC. And also, again, most people listening are maybe working with the school age population, right? I can't stress enough. Oral language is the basis for all academic learning, and I include AAC for oral language, right? You can be using AAC as your way to speak and to communicate and use oral language. If you only have 5 words, 20 words, 30 words, you have already failed. I have completely set you up to fail in your school life and trajectory. If I don't get you access to robust AAC, I have completely set you up to fail. And so, CVI or not, like that's our job to figure out the strategies, but we have to get them to actually robust systems.
Any other myths that we haven't touched? I feel like we kind of if we flowed through some of these myths already, but any other myths you can think of or that you wanted to touch on?
I think just the like two biggest ones. One, if you can't tell already, my disdain for the bubble lettering. I think bubble letters are a or bubble words is a buzzword right now. And so everyone for literacy and AAC, if a kid has CVI, is quick to bubble the words and use this bubble font that outlines the word. It's a throwback to balanced literacy. It's a throwback to like sight words, right? And it is not, in fact, helping our kids learn to read.
Okay.
And then the other one is the high contrast icons. I think I might have touched on this at ATIA, but part of having visual processing difficulties, right? You want whatever it is that you're looking at to most closely resemble the thing that it represents. So having a purple elephant, when in fact all elephants are gray, is not helpful. Did it maybe make me visually look or attend? Sure, but it didn't help me visually interpret. And so I think like we need to be really cautious about high contrast icons. They're another like big buzzword for CVI. Everyone throws high contrast pictures, but my hand is not neon green. My hand is my skin color, right? And so I think it's again really important to think about, what did this neon green color for the hand do? Not again, maybe it helped them visually look, attend, but it did not add anything for visual interpretation. And so again, for those screaming that we need to be visually interpreting icons, those high contrast icons didn't do anything for visual interpretation. So
I know what you're saying because what I end up doing with my AAC users is I show them the high contrast and I say, do you like this better or not? And some of them have been so ingrained with high contrast, they like it better. But I got to tell you, a lot of times they say no. They are the ones that telling me which symbol set that makes more sense to them. Let's compare, let's let them tell us what they see and what makes more
yeah.
sense.
I think also, as an SLP, when we don't have a lot of experience with children with CVI, we hear something and we're like, oh, I know CVI, I know word bubbling, or I know high contrast. I'm going to use that because I've heard of it, and so we're trying to use these things, but it takes a lot more experience and with students, like you're saying, talking to the students about it, but also just what have you seen that does work? Amanda, what are some resources that either a TBI or an SLP could benefit from around this topic?
I guess I would say my number one recommendation would be to look at Dr. Lewick's work. I love her book, Vision in the Brain. It is a big
It's a
book.
bit of a tough read, I gotta say.
It is. But
Mean, it's
even
like a
if
Bible. It's like a big
it's
thing.
huge. Even if you don't read it, though, there are charts in there that can really help you more quickly understand. This is the visual processing deficit. This is where there was an impact in the brain. This is what I can do to help my student. And I think for those who have been ingrained with just those 10 CVI characteristics, but are like, that doesn't fit my kid, but I also know there's something going on visually with my student. I think looking at her charts are a game changer and can help you more clearly speak to like what you're seeing. So I would say her work is something I would recommend looking at. If you ever have a chance to come to one of my long full day trainings or other trainings, like I do get more into the nitty-gritty I'm working on, but it is not coming out anytime soon. But I'm working on a like online module course right now for CVI and AAC, and I'm hoping that that might help bridge
Great.
this gap a little bit and give some more information.
Great.
And do you have any trainings coming up that people might go to?
I will probably be at Closing the Gap and I in October, and I'll probably be submitting again for ATIA and maybe CEC this year to talk a little bit more about it. Great.
Awesome.
Thank you for joining us.
Well, I knew you were going to be awesome because you say the hard things. We really appreciate the combination that is SLP TVI for this particular conversation. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Thank you for the platform to even kind of talk about these
Absolutely.
things. And I hope it helps more SLPs advocate more strongly for AAC for
Same.
the kids.
I hope that's the result as well.
The contents of this podcast were developed under contract with the Washington Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, U.S. Department of Education, and administered by Central Washington University. However, those contents did not necessarily represent the policy of the OSPI and CWU, and you should not assume endorsement by the federal and state government.